Welcome to a special part of the Dutch podcast Fantastic Film Locations. My name is Jeroen Huistens. We are going to dive into the world of one of the most iconic thrillers in cinematic history, The Silence of the Lambs. Joining me is the brilliant production designer Christy Zia, the creative force behind the production design of movie classics like Goodfellas, Revolutionary Road, Philadelphia, and of course, the famous The Silence of the Lambs. Christy Zia's masterful eye brought the film's chilling atmosphere to life, from Hannibal Lecter's stark cell to Buffalo Bill's eerie home. Christy's work helped create an unforgettable visual narrative that still haunts audiences to this day. We'll explore her creative process, the challenges she faces, and the lasting legacy of her work on this groundbreaking movie. So let's step into the mind of a true artist. Christy Zia, it's such an honor to have you on my podcast. It's an honor to talk to one of the most creative forces as far as production design is concerned, from movies like Goodfellas, Revolutionary Road, Philadelphia, and of course, The Silence of the Lambs, every one of them being true movie classics. We talked about this earlier because on November 15, 1989, production started of the Jonathan Demme film, The Silence of the Lambs. So it's 35 years ago. What's your reaction to that?
I'm sort of flabbergasted, I guess is the first word. As these things hit their big marks, you know, I start thinking, how old was I when I did these, and how did I pull this off? And you know, and I see these films now, and I'm shocked at the, you know, at the scale of them, at the complexity of them, as if I wasn't part of it. You know, I've almost gotten a kind of distance on it, even though I haven't. But there is a part of me that looks at these things, if I see them again, and I think, wow, okay, that was good. That looks good. I think that was a good job. And it's not just me. You know, no. It's so much a part, and this is the thing I keep saying to my students when I teach at NYU, which I do part-time, that it's such a collaborative art form. And so it's not at all about just the production design. It's about the acting. It's about the camera. It's about sound. It's about locations. Makeup, hair, you know, the whole thing. And so you have, the art department creates a container. Mm-hmm. And the container holds everything else. And it's really to give the actors a chance to really get into their parts, the DP to have something really great to shoot, the director to be able to play around in the space. It's like a big sandbox.
Yeah. There was a nice interview Jodie Foster gave to the British Film Institute a couple of years ago. And then she said, and I have to quote her, it inspired people to do their best work they'll probably do their whole life. Do you agree with Jodie Foster on that?
You mean the film?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, it was just this kind of blend. It was like a great salad of all these elements. And of course, we can't forget the script, you know, the story. The story has, and everything hangs on the story. So if the story isn't good, you can make the most wonderful film in the world, and it may not land because people aren't as invested as they should be because of the story.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can have all of those elements and a great story, and it still doesn't land, and then you don't understand why. You
Yeah.
know, incredible film like Beloved, which honestly I thought had the most remarkable elements to it, wasn't that popular, and you don't know why.
No, you cannot predict it.
You can't predict it. You can't predict when it comes out and what else is out there to see and how, you know. They re-released Stop Making Sense, which was one of Jonathan's early pieces, and it was really a rock concert that he did.
Yeah.
And people saw it for the first time and they went, "Oh my God,
Yeah,
you know,
amazing.
what a great, unbelievable film." And yes, so many of the films that I touch wood, so many of the films that I worked on have become classics, and I'm just thrilled.
And you
I'm
should, yeah.
thoroughly thrilled, and I just think it's about all those pieces.
In the end, The Silence of the Lambs won five Academy Awards in the five major categories. Only three movies in the whole of movie in the history managed to do that.
Oh.
It happened one night, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and The Silence of the Lambs. But working on the movie, when did you get the feeling that you were doing something, that you were involved in something very special? Do you remember?
Yeah, I think when we created the set that Hannibal Lecter was imprisoned in, we created the set and it was inspired by a whole host of different influences. There was like the Nuremberg trials and what that looked like. You know, we did a lot of research on different kinds of, you know, even abstract painters, surrealistic painters, you know, it was a com it was again, it was this kind of big melange. But when we were on the set and we were starting to shoot, and the set consisted of the staircase coming down into that sort of room where everybody was kind of the, you know, the guard room, we'll call it. And then she walks through the gates and then she starts walking down the hallway and she meets Lecter. That was all in all one set. And when we started looking at the footage, I was, you know, sitting with Jonathan and we were looking at it on the monitor. I thought, okay, this is something. This is really something. And it had to do with also how Hopkins was standing there, you know, in expectation, knew what was happening. And then, you know, dollying down that corridor until you land on his cell. It was just amazing. And then the next scene, the other scene in there where Lecter's taken that poor guard and strung him up. That whole scene when they were up in the elevator and then exploding into the room, and we were shooting that from all kinds of angles as well. That was another sort of moment. And the way that whole story got blended with, you know, her being a, you know, a small peg in a big operation, and that suddenly she's the one who's, oh, and then when she walks into the office, into the house, and she realizes that Jamie Gunn is in there. I mean, it just kept building and building and building and building.
So there was this sense that you as a team were working on something very, very special. You had that feeling already.
Yeah, but we thought that about Beloved also. You
Yeah, you
know, I
thought,
mean, that's the point. I guess what I'm trying to say is that you never know what's going to ignite and what isn't.
And
And
how
yeah.
did you get involved in the first instance? How did you get involved in the project?
So Jonathan Demme had a wonderful producer named Kenny Utt. And Kenny, let me see, how did this happen? So I had been doing some small afternoon children's television things. And I was also mostly a stylist for commercial photographers and for commercial directors. And Jonathan was about to do Married to the Mob. And Kenny Utt called me. So he had heard about me. I don't know how. But he made the call to me and he said, Jonathan is looking for a new pair of eyes. Are you interested in meeting with him? And I said, of course. And he said, okay, we'll send you the script. And he sent me the script. And I thought, this is adorable and fun and goofy. And we could have fun with this.
Yeah, you're talking about Married to the Mob, huh?
Yes, I'm talking about Mary too.
Yeah, because your reaction to the script of The Silence of the Lambs was a little bit different, I was
very
told.
Different. That's the problem, you know.
So, but you had this click with Jonathan Demme and with Ken Utt.
Absolutely. I walked into his office and he was there with Ed Saxon, his producer, and Kenny Utt. And I think maybe Ron Bozeman, was his first AD, UPM rather. UPM and first AD, I think. Well, he moved around a bit. But anyway, and I walked into that office, and it was in Times Square, and we're sitting and talking. And I said, well, I brought this book, and I think this book has a lot of feeling in it about what I think it should look, the sets should look like. And it was this Amy Arbus book, Diane Arbus's daughter, about portraits of suburban homes with the family in them and all their stuff laid out and or not, you know, whatever. So there were a bunch of different pictures. And I said, I love this. And I love this. And I love this. And I said, I think this could be so much fun to do. And suddenly Jonathan said, okay, he said, I just have to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back. Mm-hmm. And everybody left the room. So I thought they all have to go to the bathroom. And then they came back in and Jonathan said, we'd like you to do the film.
Okay, well.
There and then.
So it clicked. You had this friendship with him. And that was also the reason why he phoned you to take a look at The Silence of the Lambs, or wasn't that the case?
Yeah, so after we finished Married to the Mob and that came out and that was a success, he said, I have a new project and I'd like you to do it with me. And I said, great. So he sent me the script and I read it and I thought, oh my God, you know, I don't think I can do this. It terrified me even on the page. And I was also afraid that whatever it was that I was going to create could be copied and by some crazy person out there in the world. And it also intimidated me because I wasn't sure how it was going to unfold, and the project kind of scared me. And he said, don't be silly, it's a feminist piece. And I said, how can it be a feminist piece when this guy is skinning women to make himself a suit that he can wear, you know, and he's got people in you know, in a cage somewhere fattening them up so he can kill them and slice off their skin and turn this into, I went crazy. And he said, please, you don't understand. We're never going to see all that. He said, oh, we're going to see something, but we're not going to see that. You won't see him slicing somebody up and making skin suits out of them. But guess what? He was hovered over a sewing machine in one scene as if, and then I got complete. So I said, yes, of course. I said, okay, fine.
And as long as you can guarantee me that you're not going to show these awful pictures in the movie.
Well, I just sort of said, okay, I trust you. And I didn't.
And that's the basis of a good movie, isn't it? The trust between all the people involved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no way that anybody can work on a film if somebody doesn't trust them. Everybody in every category, every person on that crew is doing a job that they cannot do without other people.
So you used the script that was available and then you started scouting the location. You did that all by yourself?
No. I read the script by myself.
Yeah.
But then we went to Pittsburgh. And the reason why we were going to go to Pittsburgh was because Kenny said that he could make a deal with the Air National Guard so that we could make a scene inside of the hangar when they trundle Lecter out, when the senator is appealing to him to, you know, because she's lost her daughter. And so because that Pittsburgh Air National Guard was available, and also because at that point it was a very, they were doing a lot of non-union good productions there. Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood was coming out of there. They had a good PBS kind of structure to do public television. So there was crew there.
Okay.
And I think they must have also made a deal with, you know, the film commission, and we probably had sort of maybe deals at the hotels and, you know, whatever. But it was also a very rich visual place. As soon as I started driving around and we started looking for places, I kept looking, and we walked into the Soldier and Sailors Monument, which is this huge, beautiful Beaux-Arts kind of museum of soldiers and sailors, and all their faces are on the walls, and it's this kind of beautiful sort of Gilded Age kind of building. And that's the other thing, that Pittsburgh had a very, very wealthy, you know, Pittsburgh Steel was there.
Yeah.
Glass was, you know, it was a big bustling in the 1800s and early 1900s, big bustling city. So there was a lot of layers and, you know, universities like Carnegie Mellon. And so there was great fodder for locations.
Yeah.
And so when we walked into the Soldiers and Sailors Monument Museum, rather, I said, we've got to use this somewhere. I don't know where we're going to use it, but it's an amazing place. And then we saw other places, you know, Braddock had, you know, great sort of poor people's homes or working class homes for some of the subjects' families. It just was a very fertile ground for us.
But you decided to use buildings like the museum you just talked about, and also the Carnegie Natural Museum, where
yes.
Clarice Starling goes into to find
yes.
the what the cocoon really contains that's found in the throat of one of the victims.
Yes.
By the way, that museum is only 10 minutes, because I did the walk between both museums. That museum is only 10 minutes to walk from the Sailor and Soldiers Museum. But do you remember what you filmed in the Carnegie Natural Museum? Because there's a small scene with Clarice Starling walking past the dinos. And then
yes.
we're in this wonderful room with
yes.
all these displays with these
yes.
butterflies and moths.
Yes. That was there.
Okay.
That place was there. It was there. And that staircase leading up, and they had these moths inside of these frames. And in fact, as I recall, I think they were going to have to, they were having to consolidate, or they had too many things. And so they were going to have to get rid of some of these trays of bugs and flower, you know, moths and things, but it was right there. The whole thing was right there.
So the hallways where they walked past,
yeah.
it was all there, because
yeah.
I went to the museum and I didn't see it, because maybe it was behind locked doors because it's only accessible for personnel or whatever. That's probably the case.
Yeah, I think most of the, well, everything, for example, everything that leads up to going down to see Lecter in his cell, that consisted of, I think, three or four different locations. There's the exterior that you see. Then you go into the office where Chilton
yeah.
is, and that was in that was actually in that hospital or asylum or whatever it was that we found out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And there was a staircase in there. All of that was shot in one place. Then there was a other part that was this with the tiled hallways and the gates and the all of that and this kind of hump type of walking over, like all of that was in a jail inside of Pittsburgh.
Okay, so that was a different location.
That was a different location. And then we got on our set. So we matched the staircase with the tiles with the hallways that existed in Pittsburgh, and then we drew our set with the staircase coming down and that whole thing.
Yeah, but the exterior, the amazing structure you found, it's no longer there because they tear it down. They tore it down in 2011 or 2012.
You're kidding.
It's a shame because I wrote that you or I read that you used the administration building of the former Western Center. It's known as the Morganza locally, but they
Yes.
tore the building down, and
Ah,
now it's the head
no.
office of some pharmaceutical company.
Of course. Why am I not surprised?
That's too bad. So you cannot visit it, but the
They
complete,
should have kept it there and made it, you know.
It's amazing. It's still amazing when you see the movie, but you build the set in a also near Pittsburgh in a
In
industrial
Braddock.
complex.
It was a decommissioned, I want to say
Industrial hangar.
Raptor. What was it?
An industrial hangar or what
Yeah,
a.
it was a, well, it was a decommissioned, I was going to say torpedo factory, but maybe not torpedo. It was some, I think General Electric had it. No one was in it. It had just closed, and so as we were walking around looking at it for this possible sound stage, there were signs like "Goodbye, whatever, goodbye, Braddock. We'll never see you again." You know, there were all these signs of, you know, people having lost their jobs. And the thing had been very much it was very cold, and so the paint was flaking off the walls, which I thought was fabulous. So I took pictures of all the flaky paint. And so this entire place was 40 feet in the air, and you would get to it with these huge elevators that trucks could go on.
Oh, wow.
And so we had so that's where we built the basement, and it also had what it was, another thing it was going for it was, there was an opening in the floor, because I guess there must have been some kind of machinery that was in there at some time. Anyway, that's where we put the well. We dropped the well, so it was hanging off of the f second floor, so that anyone they had cranes up there. We cut open the well so we could see inside from below. And it was freezing cold. It was so cold that the paint was having trouble drying. So they had to put in these ridiculously big and probably very pollution non-friendly heaters. And then they dropped the construction guy dropped giant, giant pieces of the felt that you put underneath carpeting to deaden the sound of the space so that it didn't have such a huge amount of echo.
So, but you actually built not only the corridor with the Hannibal Lecter cell, but also the well in the home in the basement of the home of Buffalo Bill in the same location. You had all these sets together. Wow. How long did it take you to construct these things?
Well, thanks to incredible, you know, construction coordinators and painters and all of that, we didn't have that long to do it in. You know, that's a good question, and I would have to go back and really look at the schedules and stuff. But typically, you only have a couple of months, before, three at most, before you start to shoot. And in any case, so, you know, once we knew that what we were doing and we started to create the set itself on paper, you know, we would immediately start to design it and get it up as fast as we could.
I know, because time is money, eh?
Oh, is it ever? No matter how you slice it. And sometimes, like in television these days, you have so little time. You're almost falling over yourself trying to get things done, because they have, you know, they're expecting a lot of people to do a lot of work in a very, very short amount of time, and they have very high expectations because now everybody wants it to look like movies.
Yeah.
So you spend enormous amounts of money, time, effort, and your own personal sanity to get these things done.
Before the break,
Yes.
we were talking about this amazing structure that was probably in this old hangar, this industrial complex, where you built
Yes.
the sets for both the Hannibal Lecter corridor and the basement of Buffalo Bill, which must have been quite an extraordinary sight to combine those two.
Well, the corridor, all of that, yes. It was a kind of, I just remember the mayor of Pittsburgh wanting to come and see it and walk through
Okay.
the basement. And it was around Halloween. And she went inside this room, this, you know, whole little labyrinth. And she got to a room which was off the main hallway. And we told her to open the door. It was this bathtub with the old Mrs. Hoo-ha, whoever it was from the house, who lived there originally before Gum showed up, dead, you know, in a tub in water.
She
And
wasn't
she let
really
out with a
prepared to
scream.
that. She was not prepared for that
She
one.
was not prepared for it.
Okay. But by the way, this hall, because I also saw the quite interesting making of video made all these years ago about the Silence of the Lambs. And there was this, and you were telling in that documentary, you were telling about this corridor and especially about Hannibal Lecter's cell. Because that was quite something. Because the bars, you didn't want bars. So how did you come up with what is eventually the cell of Hannibal Lecter?
That was a very, very interesting conversation I remember having with Jonathan. We were already up there, obviously, and building away. And he said, you know, I've been doing tests. You know, we were giving him tests of different wide widths of bars. And we were even giving him sort of industrial netting. But there was always this thing about him wanting to see as the best possible way to see both Jody's face and Hopkins's face. And yet, if we didn't put something between them, then the audience wouldn't feel, or the audience would think that they were like right next to each other, like able to touch each other. And out of nowhere, this is why I say I really do have faith in my impulses and instincts. I said, well, you know, in banks now and in liquor stores and also in taxi cabs, they use plexiglass. And the plexiglass, you know, stops you from getting in, but you can still see everything. And that they use like 3/4 inch, it's really thick stuff. And so everybody thought that was a great idea. We got a piece of plexiglass, Jonathan and Tak Fujimoto, the DP, you know, tested it and they liked it. In fact, Tak was really happy because he could get reflections, you know, of the two, even though they weren't together, literally, but he could do that. And we were all set to go. And then there was one person in the group that was not happy.
Who was that?
The sound man. Because oh God, I'm not going to remember his name. Chris Newman, an absolutely genius sound man, said, well, it's all fine and dandy for you, but how's he going to hear her?
And
So
then?
then I said, well, you know, like in cabs, they have these little holes and they have them in the liquor stores as well. And so that's how they hear each other. So,
And it's also used brilliantly in the movie because
yes.
he smells her.
Yes.
Did Anthony Hopkins
He,
come up to that particular scene
yes.
all by himself, right at
Yes.
that moment?
I'm sure. You can
Because it's
ask him.
amazing. Yeah.
But I'm sure. I mean, look, we were in there rehearsing, I'm sure, beforehand, and the holes were there just almost last minute. But yeah, we did that, and the rest is history.
Yeah. But did you also have the feeling, because the plexiglass also gives away, it gives a feeling of this must be something really dangerous, because
Yes.
bars, you can stick your finger through the bars, but you
Yes.
cannot touch somebody who's behind thick glass.
Exactly. It was like he was a specimen also, and he couldn't, no one could get at him. And in fact, because I think there is somewhere in the script where they say, you know, this is what he did to the last, guard, because he was only in a cage, in a jail cell with typical things, and he bit the somehow or other he got the guy to get close enough to him so he could bite his nose off or something.
But then
So
after, in the story, after he's has left his cell there and he goes to the cell we already talked about in the museum, this wonderful wonderful building indeed, as you told the listeners, but he's in a cage in that room as well. So the
correct.
bars weren't a problem over there.
Not as much because we made them wide enough just so that he could see her and they could have their dialogue and you understood that there were bars there. But I think there's one point where there's a hyper close up of Jody while she's talking. And then that was just, film movie license. You know, we just moved in on her, just like he moved in on her to sort of hear what she was going to say.
And there's
But
the
that's
end.
really how he was able to get that guard, you know.
Absolutely. And there's this crucial touch between Clarice and
Yes.
Hannibal, because they
Yes.
touch fingers.
Yes. And you would wouldn't have had we wouldn't have had that if he was in a
Absolutely.
plexiglass.
You have to tell us about this amazing structure, because I've been in the room in the museum,
Yes.
and the nice lady at the desk, they put on the lights because they were renovating the cage that is still in that room. There
Are
is
you
a
kidding?
structure, yeah, there is a structure in that room. They put it there because people are coming to the museum not only to see the museum part, but also to go to the first level to see the room with the cage of Dr. Hannibal Lecter. But you must tell the listeners the story about the artist that influenced you to create this amazing scene with the light and the banners and the guard. How did you come up with that?
Well, again, you let your mind go and strange things come out. That really came about because I had seen and I had always been very affected by Francis Bacon, the painter Francis Bacon, and his series that he did about the Pope. And he did more than one. I mean, if you see his work, there's a variety of the same one, and some you understand that there's a kind of square over him, and sometimes there's even bar. I don't know if they're bars really, but there's a square over him, and he's got this really, really scary mouth. Yeah, and I thought that whole thing somehow or other I connected to this cage that we were going to create for Lecter. And all the other stuff, well, I had a slightly different version of what you see there.
Oh.
Originally, and this was like really literally maybe a weekend before we were going to shoot in it, I showed the final work this installation to Jonathan. And the way I thought about it too was that there was going to be like light over his head, like a rock, like one of these rock concerts with all the big superstructure and the big lights. And so he was never allowed to be There was never any shade or shadow in his space. And so we rigged these big rock lights over his head, and we threw some smoke in for good measure. Actually, Tack wanted that. And the original, I had asked the set decorator, Karen O'Hara, to get me a sheep's carcass. And what I wanted to do was to take, you know, to create a dummy of the body of the guard and the legs and the pants of the guard, and the chest was going to be splayed open and we were going to see the ribs.
Oh my God.
That's how far I was going. By this time, I was not afraid of anything.
No, I can tell.
And so I had Jonathan and Ed Saxon, his producer, and Kenny Ott come, and they walked in to the space, and everything was lit, and this body was inside the cage, all splayed out, and the lights were on and everything. So I had the whole thing on, you know, apart from the smoke, for him to see, for them to see. And they walked in, they got halfway into the room, and they got a little further into the room, and then they both turned around simultaneously, and I think Kenny did too, and almost ran out of the room. And I...
You really scared them.
I did. And I went outside, and they were all kind of in a huddle. And I said, so, what? And I think it was Ed said, people are going to get up out of their seats and throwing up as they were leaving. They'll run out of the theater. And I said, really? And they said, yes. I said, but this is like an installation. You know, this is Francis Bacon and da, 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 da. And they said, no. He said, also, however would he have made that kind of, you know, there's not that much time for him to have, you know, gutted this guy and taken all the meat off his bones and eaten them. And you know, they were all into it. And I said, well, we're doing a little cinematic license here.
No, make believe.
Right. I mean, and they said, no, 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 this wouldn't happen. This wouldn't happen. So there was like a big panic. And Carl Fullerton, who's this remarkable makeup guy, he does all kinds of fabulous makeup. He said, I have an idea. I have a dummy guy, and I'm going to open up his chest, and I'll put all kinds of crap in there that it looks like guts and gore and whatever. Mm-hmm. And we'll put that on the, and I said, and we'll put it inside. And no, Jonathan said, no, put it right on the outside of the cage. So in my opinion, I think that was worse.
Okay.
Than what I was proposing.
But when you saw the final scene, were you really impressed?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it looks marvelous. It's...
Yeah, and also because the smoke added a bit of mystery to it. It wasn't like a bold kind of horrendous, but it would have been equally horrific if you moved in closer and closer and closer.
Oh, of course.
Then saw these, you know, these splayed out rib bones.
Yeah. What I like so much about the scene is that you, before the police enters the hall, you already see the display through the glass of the door.
Yes. And you would not have figured that out.
Yeah.
As
And
well.
Then it opens, and then you see the terror on their face. And it's really a manifestation of pure evil, knowing that the doctor did that. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason why Trump likes Hannibal Lecter. I know that. That's all I'm going to say on that subject.
Okay. Let's do something. I want to go a little bit back to the Hannibal Lecter, his first prison with the plexiglass and the holes in it, because I came across some information that the Hollywood Museum in Los Angeles has recreated the hallway, and they tell people that it's done by original props from the movie. Do you know anything about that?
Yes, I do. I was out there doing Red Dragon, which is the prequel to Silence of the Lambs, and Brett Ratner was the director on that. And interestingly, They were shooting, we were getting, you know, we were in the design process, and Universal was going to distribute Red Dragon. And MGM said, you can't use the cell. That's our intellectual property. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. I made this cell. What about me? You know? And
Yeah, it's from
so
your
for a little
creative mind.
while, I was having to invent a different kind of cell that he was in prior to the one that he wound up in, as if he was still with the regular bars, and you know, this was where he would have bit the guard. And I created a whole, we designed this whole thing. We never built it because at the very last minute, MGM, in exchange for the foreign rights to Red Dragon, allowed Universal to use it. So we
Okay.
built it again. We
For a
built
dragon.
the real one, and we built it again. And then afterwards, I'm not sure how this happened, but I think either Universal did it or maybe the museum heard about it, but somehow or other, we were contacted and they wanted to find out if it was possible to put it on in their museum. So my art director sort of helped them figure it out. And so the whole thing was dismantled and brought over. And
So it's
in
actually the set you built for Red Dragon that we can now see in the museum in Los Angeles.
Yes, and I think, I don't know about if the original props are in there. I know that there were artifacts, you know, like the art that he had on his walls. I'm not sure if we if that was actually, because I know that Jonathan had gotten some of the pieces of that room, and maybe I know, but we had to really actually kind of change the whole look of it. And maybe what we did, I'm gonna have to go back and look at Red Dragon again, but what was on the walls could have possibly been different, but it had been Florence picture, you know, he had done
Yeah,
sort of
drawings, yeah.
images of Florence and with pencils or whatever he was allowed to work with, maybe charcoal. So I'm not sure if all what kind of props they have in there.
Okay, but it's something to keep in mind if you visit Los Angeles
Yes,
one
I should
day.
go and see it. Absolutely.
Yeah,
Well, it was
and
amazing after we built the whole thing, the number of people from the executive parts of Universal that came over so they could have their pictures taken inside the hell.
that's a good story.
It was ridiculous. My agent was in there with all his people, and there were lots of people came over there.
And then we have to also have to talk about the House of Buffalo Bill, because you found this location in a place called Perryopolis near Pittsburgh, where you did the exterior for the house where Clarice knocks on the door, and we have this basement. But first the house, because can you explain? It's always something that bothers me. It not really bothers me, but I cannot explain to people why would you pick a certain house in a village that's almost 30 minutes or an hour drive from Pittsburgh to recreate for this particular scene in a movie? What was it that attracted you to that particular house?
Well, I'm sure we looked at a lot of them because we always do. I loved that this house was kind of by itself. It had the right footprint. That was the other issue, because you had to figure out what kind of what kind of basement slash if he had carved his way into the, you know, into the soil, into the bedrock, whatever the house is sitting on, because the basement was, you know, definitely bigger than what a normal basement could handle. So it had to have a bit of width to it. It had to have a certain look to it. I love that kind of old Victorian feel. And it was so pretty much sitting by itself. The other houses were not so close by, and I think Jamie Gunn would have liked that also. And there was this crazy trail, train track in front of it. which looked kind of desolate. And the inside of it, the layout of the inside was a sort of center hall colonial style thing where you could see things to the right and the left, and where his sort of the dining room that's taken over by gum and all this stuff is all over the place, where the moth lands on something in the sunlight. That would have been probably the dining room. And then the kitchen was great. It was big enough for us to load that up with all kinds of horribleness. And there was a door leading down to the basement that was perfect, that when you open that door, you can look straight down. And in fact, you again, the staircase became the connecting tissue between the house and the set. So what you see is he comes in and he looks around, and it's she comes in rather, and looks around, and it's loaded up with all kinds of old stuffy things that an old woman would probably have collected. And she was probably, a seamstress or a tailor or something. So she has all this stuff lying around. And we used the images that we saw of Ed Gein's kitchen, who is a
The
serial
serial
killer.
killer, yeah.
And we the images that we found of his kitchen, which were filthy, filthy, dirty kitchen, and we did that in the kitchen, and then downstairs. So she would go through the hall, through that doorway, down the stairs. You see her going down, and then we pick her up on the set, coming down that same stairs, into this little ante room, which was like an old laundry kind of a place, and then a door, and inside the door, all then you start to go in. So at a certain point, and we never really kind of tell you exactly when, he was basically probably would have had to have carved out those rooms.
Yeah.
After, a certain footprint had been reached, he probably just kept going, and he probably dug. And the well, we sort of said, had been an old well, again, decommissioned. And so it wasn't completely finished on top, so that it could be
Used for something else.
used for something else.
Well, yeah, I told you earlier that I've been to the house, and it was bought by a fan a couple of years ago, and he not rebuild it, but he recreated it, and it's in a really an amazing and terrifying place to be, because you enter the room, and the kitchen is not that well filthy as in the movie, but it gives
Yes.
you the same vibe. There's also a doll of a puppet of Hannibal Lecter in his hallway, but and you go to the to this basement, and he recreated it with a sort of with the sewing machine and all the dresses and a jar with a head in it, and it's and there's also a door that leads to a well, which is not as deep as you can see in the movie, but it's really a terrifying place. But people are such big fans of the world you created that they want to relive it. Can you imagine that fans
No.
want to relive
No.
it?
No, I mean, I guess that's what happens, when people are affected by something, and then they go and they see the, I'm sure, I don't know what he must do on Halloween.
Oh yeah, he rents out his place, and people enjoy the night over there, and they stay
Are you
there. And yeah,
serious?
absolutely. I've seen the bedrooms, and it's all Hannibal Lecter over there with the cushions and the wall, and it's all over the place. And it, because he's really a fan of the movie,
Oh my
and
God.
Chris Rowan is his name, and he allowed me to go through the house a couple of hours when I was all alone with my wife. And it's also a nice story I tell the people in the podcast that a gentleman showed us around, and then he had to leave, but he showed us the basement, and then my wife and I returned upstairs, and my wife said to me, I'm never going back into that basement again, because she was so terrified, because there were also these voice activated machines on the wall.
Oh,
When you go down and movement
sound effects.
sound effects. So you go into the basement, and it registers that there's somebody walking. So then,
Oh
well,
my God.
it's the sounds from the movie start to be played through speakers. So it's really terrifying to be there. On the other hand, it's a movie with everything that was put into it by the actors, by the production designer I'm now talking to, and the artist, and Jonathan Demme, and the editing, and the camera, and the lightning, and the special effects, and it's such an amazing movie to see and to see again after all these years. Is there something in this movie you're particularly proud of? a set you created?
Not really. I just think it's all of a piece. You know, it's one thing connects you to another, and it connects you to another. And, you know, then when you go and visit the guy, the house of the one of the victims, and you go into her bedroom and you see her, the innocence of her life there, and this little ballerina that goes around, and underneath the ballerina are all these photos that someone had obviously. You know, it's the precursor of all the horrible things that are happening on internet now.
Yeah.
You know, with young people. But you know, the charm and the sadness of that against all the horror and the suspense. So, you know, what's great about it is that it does also point out the victims and how the victims respond to people like this.
Yeah. Absolutely.
You know, when I went down into the basement of Quantico, where we actually shot her jogging in the opening, where she's jogging in the woods, we were at Quantico, which is outside of Washington. I think it's in Virginia.
Yeah.
And we went down and visited with John Crawford, who, at that time anyway, was running the behavioral institute of, you know, criminology or whatever the thing was called. And I got a total case of claustrophobia, because they all their offices were fitted out in what had been a bomb shelter.
Mm-hmm.
Had, you know, so that the CIA could go down there and, you know, continue to do their work. So there were no windows. And it was very, very small kind of office. You go down and down in the elevator and you get out. And when I walked into Crawford's office, he had on his wall a case that he was working on.
A real case.
Images on the wall, you know, and this was a real live person doing this to people. And I couldn't stay in the room. I went in, I took a look at it. I took some pictures and I said, I have to go upstairs.
Yeah, I read in an interview that Scott Glenn, who plays Jack Crawford, also saw pictures that still haunts him to today.
Yes. And in fact, he also, this I heard at the time, had asked, Crawford either said, you can listen to these or you can, but because the case that Crawford was working on, apparently the guy who they were looking for recorded all of his victims as they were being attacked. So that's also what Crawford, John Glenn heard, and that really scared him. And in fact, what he did, as I understand it, is he called the FBI, his local FBI, and he said, I would really like it if you guys could just keep an eye on my house and my family.
Yeah,
doing this.
It's where real life and fiction comes together.
Yeah.
Yeah. You told so in images about what you saw in that basement at Quantico. Where did you recreate the office scenes?
That was another set.
And that was not on the same set as you built the prison hallway.
I can't remember. It must have been.
Let's.
I think it was. I can't remember.
Okay.
I have to ask Tim Galvin. Tim Galvin is the art director.
Yeah.
Who's now a production designer as well.
Okay.
And he's a great person to talk to.
Okay.
And
Well, maybe.
he'll have great. He created something, I think. It was he who did it. It was a board game called Gum the Game, and
Oh.
it was a board game where, like Chutes and Ladders or one of those, kids board games, and you roll the dice and you go a certain number of paces, and
Yeah.
if and then you go through the moth room, and oh,
Oh
that's
my
a whole
God.
other thing, the moth room. I mean, the
So,
moths were very cold and they wouldn't move because we were in such a cold space. So, if for no other reason than the moths, we had to warm it up.
But no moths were harmed during the process of making the movie. No.
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I
Well,
have a
let's.
feeling they were froze, they were cold. I think they were probably colder than they wanted to be.
To be honest, I think I can talk to you more than 3 hours about this same subject, and I would love to continue, but we have to round it up somewhere.
Okay.
And taking a little bit distance from what you've created and what you've seen create by other of your colleagues, what do you consider in general some of the most m magnificent sets
Ah.
that you really like? That you've seen in other movies. Are
Oh my
there
God. Oh, I know you asked
too many?
me about that. There's so many. I mean, let's say this. There are amazing directors out there. There are amazing designers out there. And I just recently, I can talk about something that I saw recently that I thought was absolutely extraordinary in every way, which was Gladiator 2
Yeah.
that Ridley Scott did. The detail, the attention to detail, the scope of what they built. When you see these, I mean, and now of course there's a blend of AI, not AI, visual effects. Although some of the visual effects are being created in AI, and that's where things are getting very dicey in our world. But the scale of build and support, visual support to a story, when you're looking at this, the Gladiator particularly is one, but Wicked is another. I mean, when you're dealing with this kind of huge scale, Barbie is another.
Yeah.
When you think about all of these and the effort that gets put into it and what is real and what has been modified in visual effects. But I heard, and this is what's so extraordinary, John, I think his name is Arthur
Arthur Max did the production
Max.
design for Ridley Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who's just an astonishing genius. But he built four of those. You haven't seen the film, maybe,
Yeah,
but
I've seen
you've
it.
seen it.
Yeah.
So they built four of those boats to
That's
scale for
yeah.
humans to be in. Four of them they built. They built the entire Colosseum
It's amazing.
so that they could run cameras simultaneously. I think he said they had five cameras always shooting.
Yeah.
They had real people in the audience. All those were animatronic animals
Yeah.
with small people inside them. So they were real. Everything was real. There wasn't any of the kind of Marvel-esque things that happen.
Yeah. It's
So when you.
an amazing set
Yeah.
that he built for Gladiator 2. That's absolutely true.
And
But
so when I see something like that, I just think, well, it's just a huge undertaking, and it's so beautifully conceived and shot and everything. Even if you don't like the story, and some in that case, the story is very interesting. Is it better than the first one? I don't know. But the idea, the thought that went into it.
you see, I would really like to thank you for the time you took to talk to me. It's been a hell of a ride. And I really enjoy talking. One last question. If there's ever the opportunity for you to come to Amsterdam to talk about your career and about the movies you did and all these wonderful stories, are you open to that?
Sure.
Because maybe I will try to connect me with some people here in the Netherlands to be able to bring you over, because I think there are a lot of people in Amsterdam and in the Netherlands who would love to meet you and hear you talk enthusiastically like you just did. about your career, about the wonderful movies you made, and especially about Silence of the Lambs. So if you're open to that, I will do my utmost best to get you to Amsterdam one day.
I would love that. I love it. I was in Amsterdam a couple times, and I have a dear, dear, dear friend who's Dutch, who lives upstate New York. But I would be honored to come.
Okay. So thank you for this moment. I hope we can keep in touch. And
yes.
Thank you so much, and all the best with all the upcoming movies that I hope you will be able to make. Thank you so much.
I hope so too.
Thank you.
This was lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Okay. Take care.
You've been listening to a truly special conversation with the brilliant production designer Christy Zia. Excerpts from this interview were featured in the Dutch podcast Fantastic Film Locations, but Christy's insights deserved more attention, so I'm thrilled to share this full interview with you today. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. And if you'd like to know more, feel free to visit my website, fantastischefilmlocaties.nl. And as you go about your day, I'd love for you to remember this. The next time you watch a movie, take a moment to appreciate the incredible professionals behind the scenes, talented artists like Christy Zia, who help create something for you to enjoy, reflect on, and remember. Thanks for listening, and have a wonderful day.